of southern Lebanon alongside United Nations peacekeepers. That being said, there have been dozens of instances where Israel has struck parts of southern Lebanon and parts north of the Litani. There have been reports of Israeli jets overflights, drone overflights, and this has pretty much frustrated the Lebanese government, the army. Now, it's really unclear what measures they're going to take. Hezbollah has been very quiet on that front since the ceasefire. They've been focusing a lot on commemorating Hassan Nasrallah, their leader, who was killed by an Israeli airstrike back in September, doing some community work and that sort of thing. We do know the army has been very public about these violations, particularly ones that have struck military personnel, and that they say they have complained, and the Lebanese government is doing the same, apparently. This is a really big test for the new monitoring framework for the ceasefire, which is headed by the United States, and is supposed to bring life back into this UN Security Council resolution from back in 2006, which they're trying to have implemented right now. It's really unclear what the Lebanese government's going to do beyond that, whether they're trying to put the trust into the system and hope that Washington asked the Israelis to maybe, you know, to stop these overflights and these attacks. It's really unclear. But over the past few days, these issues are still, you know, continuing. And it has brought some doubt among some people in Lebanon about whether this ceasefire can
Kareem,
hold.
Kareem, we're going to have to leave it there. We hope to do a post-show interview with you. Kareem Shahayeb is the Beirut-based journalist reporting on Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq for the Associated Press. A belated birthday to Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO Portland.
KBOO's 2024 Catalog of Connections is hot off the presses. To get your copy featuring your favorite programs, letters from the board, and so much more, contact our membership director by calling 971-801-1381. That's 971-801-1381 or by emailing membership@kboo.org. We can't wait to connect with you.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Albany teachers are still on strike after a tentative deal falls through. Portland may see its streetcar service expand to the Montgomery Park office building, and Intel's CEO Pat Gelsinger steps down unexpectedly amidst the company's financial peril. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 2nd, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eliza Yurkov. The three-week-long teacher strike in Albany, Oregon, was supposed to end today. But by Sunday night, the tentative deal fell through, and the union entered its fourth straight week of striking. In late October, 92% of the union voted to authorize the strike after 9 months of bargaining with the Albany School District. The main issues for the teachers were smaller class sizes, safety measures, and prep times. Last week, the union sent out a preemptively celebratory letter listing agreements on professional development, health and safety policies, and prep time. But it also raised concerns about the district meeting with parents behind the teachers' backs to decrease individualized lesson plan terms. The district also announced it would be shutting off health care and benefits to striking teachers since they were not, quote, active employees. The union was supposed to vote on the finalized deal today, but the district included a, quote, return to work agreement last minute. The union and district could not agree on whether teachers will be compensated for the days they were on strike and how many days can be made up during the school year or the summer. Dana Lovejoy, the president of the Greater Albany Education Association, said, quote, we are flabbergasted that after 3 weeks of strike, bargaining every day but two over Thanksgiving break, and nearly securing a full agreement today over the entirety of the contract except one appendix, this district's bad faith power plays have now cost us an agreement. After repeatedly violating federal labor law throughout the strike, the district's arrogance and the unending incompetence and anti-teacher vitriol of this school board will now unnecessarily keep students out of classes even longer, end quote. Portland City Council will consider a plan to extend the North-South Portland streetcar line out to the Montgomery Park building in Northwest Portland this Wednesday. The project has been years in the making. The Bureau of Transportation started exploring it in earnest in 2018. Sean Canny is a transportation planner with PBOT. Canny explains the route of the streetcar and the benefits in an informational video from the Bureau. Here's an excerpt.
After evaluating several different routes, Northwest 23rd Avenue was selected. On this route, the streetcar's existing NS line will extend north along Northwest 23rd Avenue and turn west onto a newly built multimodal Roosevelt Street that extends toward Montgomery Park. For its return, the streetcar will head east on Northwest Wilson Street and back down Northwest 23rd Avenue to connect to the existing tracks on Northwest Lovejoy. This route was chosen because it offers an affordable, direct route to Montgomery Park. It's designed to accommodate traffic demands now and will support phased growth over time. The project will include improvements for pedestrians and people bicycling in the new district. It will also be built without wires, as new hybrid battery technologies will allow the streetcars to switch effortlessly between the existing system and this new extension, reducing construction costs and limiting impacts on 23rd Avenue. We'll also leverage this project to help pay for a complete rebuild of crumbling Northwest 23rd Avenue between Lovejoy and Vaughan, including replacing aging utilities, new stormwater facilities, and accessibility upgrades, all while preserving almost all of the existing parking.
That was Sean Canny from PBOT. The project will involve building a new Northwest Roosevelt Street through land that was industrial and rezoning some of the area for new development. City documents detailing the project say the streetcar is a key connection to a future mixed-use, affordable, and equitable district. They relate the improvements to other Northwest Portland neighborhoods like Slabtown and the Pearl District, which were once more industrial areas. If adopted, the Montgomery Park expansion would be the first infrastructure expansion for Portland streetcar since finishing the Tillicum Crossing in 2015. Written testimony is open until 5 p.m. on Tuesday, tomorrow. If Portland City Council approves the expansion, the next step is getting the funding, which could mean going to the federal government in 2026. If funding moves forward, construction on the project could begin as soon as 2028. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger announced his resignation yesterday amidst the company's financial turmoil. The multinational technology company was founded in 1968 and created the first commercially available microprocessor in 1971. The technology boom of the late 1990s and early 2000s ushered in semiconductor and processor companies competing to make the highest powered, smallest computer chips imaginable. Some companies leveraged collaboration to boost profits, like Apple in 2005, when it announced it would be using Intel's x86 processor for its Macintosh computers. For the next decade, Intel would dominate the market and supply companies with smaller and faster computer chips, accelerating personal computers to smartphones. But in 2016, Intel was slow to update their core processors due to manufacturing issues and suffered cyber attacks due to security flaws. Intel's main competitor, AMD, introduced a new chiplet-based design that surged its CPU market dominance amid Intel's stagnation. And in 2020, Apple moved away from using Intel's processors altogether and started using their own silicon technology, significantly cutting into Intel's profits. Apple's move to use in-house CPUs instead of outsourcing encouraged other PC manufacturers to do the same, or at least move away from Intel. Pat Gelsinger worked at Intel as the chief technology officer before taking over as chief executive in February of 2021. Over the past 3 years, he was unable to bring the company back from its steady decline. Before Gelsinger, the company could not keep up with the fierce competition, and once he stepped into office, AI development plunged Intel into further irrelevance. NVIDIA, a once tiny Intel competitor, invested in chips that can power AI data centers when Intel didn't, and now NVIDIA is 33 times bigger in its market value. All Gelsinger could do is cut costs by laying off 15% of its workforce and selling some of its campuses. The Biden administration finalized an $8 billion grant to Intel last week as an effort to revitalize U.S. chip manufacturing. But even that deal suffered from Intel delaying deadlines and making risky financial decisions. As Trump takes office, the possibility that Qualcomm takes over Intel may turn into a reality under an administration that is less aggressive with antitrust law. The company will conduct a search for a permanent CEO, while interim co-CEOs David Zisner and Michelle Johnston Holthaus oversee operations. Old telecommunications cables sheathed in lead have been found in the ground around utility poles in Portland neighborhoods. Elisa Scheel, an Oregon State University professor, and graduate student Ashley Sutton have been studying the effects of those cables on the soil. Lead does not break down over time. It accumulates. So if the lead sheathing on the cables is leaching into the soil, that could pose a health risk to anyone or thing interacting with the ground. Telecom companies have maintained that the sheathing poses no danger, but haven't disclosed their locations. Scheel and Sutton are mapping the cable locations and understanding their risk, despite state and federal public health officials failing to conduct much research on the subject. The cables were installed across the U.S. between the late 1800s and 1960s as part of Bell's Systems Regional Telephone Network. Companies like AT&T, Verizon, and CenturyLink have replaced new sheathing with plastic or fiber optic ones. Last year, the Wall Street Journal published an exposé that more than 2,000 lead-sheathed cables could be found throughout the United States, and not much had been done about removing them. It is unclear what government agency should hold these companies accountable and how to pay for the removal. Senator Ron Wyden was one of a dozen senators who wrote a letter to the Federal Communications Commission asking the agency to provide the cable's locations and other related information. In Oregon, the Public Utilities Commission has been working to determine the locations, statuses, and plans of lead sheath lines owned by the telephone companies it regulates. In court filings, AT&T and Verizon reported around 300,000 miles of lead-sheathed cables, but still refused to disclose their exact locations. So far, Elisa Scheel's research has identified 40 Portland neighborhoods with lead-sheathed cables. She has also found them in Gresham, Bend, Corvallis, Albany, Newport, and McMinnville. A map of the neighborhoods can be found on the Oregonian's website. In an Environmental Protection Agency investigation, it reported elevated levels of lead in the soil, but concluded no immediate danger at those sites. The EPA investigated sites in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, but did no testing in Oregon. Scheel says the risks in Oregon could differ because the climate and soils are different. The Oregon Health Authority told the Oregonian that it is aware of Scheel's research and has added lead-sheathed cables to its list of potential sources for lead exposure investigations. A plan described as the basis for Trump's mass deportations served a very different purpose. Federal workers prepare to defend their jobs if they lose civil service protections, and Ohio enacts bathroom restrictions on transgender people. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Mexicans, in terms of border crossers, they account for less than a third of all migrants crossing the United States without authorization. To deport those people is much more complicated and much more expensive.
Katrina Burgess at Tufts University says President-elect Donald Trump's mass migrant deportations could be a logistical mess and cost the economy trillions. She notes his plan's based on one used by President Dwight Eisenhower, but that smaller operation just aimed to get Texas ranchers to legally hire Mexican guest workers instead of underpaying illegal immigrants. Undocumented workers represent about 5% of all employees. They're especially concentrated in farm work, meatpacking, and construction at a time of labor shortages and high food and housing costs. Federal workers are also bracing for what's next. Trump says he wants to reclassify many as Schedule F, stripping them of civil service protections and making them subject to firing without cause. Otis Johnson with the American Federation of Government Employees says the people who make sure Social Security checks go out and veterans get their health care can't be treated like Twitter employees.
We represent over 800,000 federal workers, and we can't remove 80% and still expect to be able to serve the American people with the same proficiency and knowledge that they have right now.
Breaking a promise not to, President Joe Biden is pardoning his son Hunter. The younger Biden faced gun and tax charges dated to a time of drug addiction. Trump says he's going to fire FBI Director Christopher Wray and replace him with close longtime loyalist Kash Patel. Patel has promoted Trump's contention that his legal troubles are the result of Democratic conspiracies. The Justice Department shut down a Russian-backed climate misinformation network, but a new report says that hasn't stopped the falsehoods. Climate Action Against Disinformation examined accounts tied to defunct company Tenet Media, which was funded by Moscow. Researcher Sean Buchan says the right-wing influencers are still promoting conspiracy theories, such as one claiming the government is replacing livestock with lab-grown meat.
We know that this disinformation exists, but to have a disinformation operation on U.S. soil paid directly from Russia is a surprise.
Ohio is enacting restrictions on bathroom access for transgender people. The law passed on a party-line vote requires schools kindergarten to college to designate lockers and bathrooms based on sex assigned at birth. Supporters say it addresses privacy and safety, but State Senator Nikki Antonio calls it a civil rights issue for trans students.
There has been an effort to segment them off because they are the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, the most misunderstood.
Idaho advocates are waiting to see if they have the signatures for a 2026 ballot measure allowing access to abortion until viability. 7 out of 10 states just approved similar measures. Melanie Falwell is with Idahoans United for Women and Families.
If there's anything that was clear in November's election, it's that abortion amendments and abortion laws, laws that expand access to reproductive options, do well at the ballot.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive, special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for news in depth. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be clear and cold with a low of 33 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a chill, getting up to 45 degrees. Today in history, the jig is up! In 2001, Enron filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy after stealing and defrauding its employees as a way to rebound on the stock market. Jeffrey Skilling, one of the CEOs at the time, served 12 years in prison, and Kenneth Lay, the other CEO, died from heart failure 2 months after being convicted for fraud. The quote of the day is from Nklapamuk writer Therese Marie Milot. In her memoir, Heartberries, she writes, quote, "To ascend, there must be a dark, a descent. I'm a river widened by misery, and the potency of my language is more than human. In my culture, I believe we carry pain until we reconcile with it through ceremony. Pain is not framed like a problem with a solution." Indigenous Ohlone people and supporters gathered for the 28th annual Shell Mound Prayer Walk in Emeryville, California on Friday. Gaming expansion does not seem likely in Oregon, to the disappointment of some tribes, and it's the ideal time for tribes to burn hazel across the Pacific Northwest. With more on those stories, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. As thousands of shoppers took advantage of Black Friday deals last week, indigenous Ohlone people and supporters gathered for the 28th annual Shell Mound Walk in Emeryville, California. The event is to bring attention to the shopping malls built on burial sites known as shell mounds. Christina Onnestad reports.
Some 200 Ohlone activists and supporters gathered at the Berkeley Shell Mound for a Shell Mound to Shell Mound walk, bringing attention to the indigenous villages and burial sites from Berkeley, California to neighboring Emeryville, where shopping centers are built. Karina Gold is tribal chair for the Confederated Villages of Lujan Nation.
Bay Street Mall was placed on there in the late 1990s, and the city of Emeryville knew, even though they were cleaning up a brownfield at the time, that that was a sacred site and one of the largest cemeteries in the area, and yet they decided to do it anyway. We protested for many weeks at city council and zoning meetings in Emeryville, and still they allowed it to happen. So it's a reminder that even though there's buildings on top, even though there's asphalt, that these shell mounds, these burial sites, remain in our area. And they're covered by all of these places.
Gold first organized the rally nearly 30 years ago. Then 3 years ago, she passed on the organizing to her daughter, Deja Gould. Now they march and stop at shell mound sites and villages along the way that were also developed or paved over. Here's Deja Gould.
We've started doing this walk to set prayers down, to set intentions down, but also to bring awareness to community and people that our people are still here, our people are still active.
For National Native News, I'm Christina Onnestad in Berkeley, California.
Expansion of gaming across Oregon doesn't seem likely, a development some tribes are hoping for. During a recent press call of tribal officials, Governor Tina Kotick said she appreciated visiting with all 9 federally recognized tribes within Oregon this year. However, in terms of allowing more development of gaming venues...
My position has not changed, and we have had fruitful conversations about the importance of gaming.
The Coquel tribe has expressed interest in an electronic bingo facility in Medford, which Kotick said she opposed in 2023. Her stance continues a one tribe, one casino policy that's been the mainstay for the state. And for tribes across the Pacific Northwest, it's an ideal time to burn hazel. About a dozen Native people gathered yesterday to burn hazel growth in a rural spot used for traditional ecological inquiry programs near Eugene, Oregon. Jerome Viles is a Siletz tribal member who led the burn demonstration. He says this practice makes for better baskets for his people.
When it burns, it stimulates the plant to send up really straight, long shoots. So when it doesn't burn, we're still able to get shoots, but they're not as straight or long. So basket weavers really want those long, straight hazel shoots to weave baby baskets and all sorts of other baskets.
Nearby, TEIP leader Joe Scott, also Siletz, pairs down hazel with a hedge trimmer. Jerome Biles' father, Drew, explains.
That's one technique that we've resorted to since reservation times. Hazel likes to be coppiced. It likes to put up straight shoots after coppicing, and that's what Joe's doing right now.
The senior Viles appreciated his son taking his knowledge of hazel and basketry and putting it to use.
Gives me encouragement and makes my heart a lot lighter when you see young people who are practicing their culture.
In roughly a year and a half, the hazel will be harvested for baskets. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
A proposal to deploy a new nuclear energy technology in the Northwest is seen by some as a distraction from other proven renewable energy sources. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Interest in nuclear energy as a solution to dirty sources of power is growing, including with a proposal in the Northwest. However, some critics say it could divert attention from more practical renewable energy solutions. Amazon has signed an agreement with X Energy to build new nuclear technology known as small modular reactors to meet the company's growing energy needs. The aim is to build these reactors at the Hanford nuclear site along the Columbia River. Kelly Campbell with Columbia Riverkeeper says companies are looking into nuclear because they want it to be a magic bullet for climate change.
It's a distraction. It's a shiny object that you can say, look, over here, we're going to do, quote, clean nuclear power. But it's going to take 15 years at least to build these things. And meanwhile, they're still part of the problem of trying to get more energy supply for the data centers and AI needs.
While small modular reactors are seen as an innovative way to provide nuclear energy without having to build large power plants, none has been built in the United States or approved by the federal government. An Oregon-based company called NuScale, that's at the forefront of small modular reactor design, had its only customer back out last year because of repeated delays in the project. Campbell says the location of the project that Amazon and X-Energy are moving forward with is also a concern.
It's right on the Columbia River, and if there's an emergency, if there's an accident with any of these nuclear facilities at Hanford, it would affect all of them. And so you may end up in a situation where you're not able to get in and do the things that you need to do in order to protect people from radiation.
After Amazon and Google expressed interest in nuclear to fuel their growing energy needs, the U.S. Department of Energy announced it would invest $900 million in this technology. But Campbell is convinced that money would be better spent on proven technology like wind and solar.
When we start spending it on nuclear, which people have called the most expensive way to boil water, then that's an opportunity cost that we're losing in terms of spending that on things that we know will work and are safer, quicker to build, and cheaper.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The staff of Portland's award-winning local street paper, Street Roots, have decided to unionize with the Communications Workers of America, or CWA Local 7901. The paper has been around for 25 years, and it's sold by people experiencing homelessness. One of the central points of focus for Street Roots are the root causes of homelessness, and the Street Roots Workers Guild say that's part of what's motivated them to unionize. They're asking the Street Roots board to voluntarily recognize their union. In their letter to the board, they write, quote, "We believe a union will strengthen Street Roots by democratizing processes directly impacting our workplace and community." The letter continues, quote, "We are committed to a relentless pursuit of a just world in the face of threats to justice. Utilizing the collective imagination, our union will promote the pay equity, adequate staffing, and safety measures necessary to that work," end quote. They write in the letter that workers unanimously want to join the union, and if the Street Roots Board doesn't recognize them by Wednesday evening, they'll file for a union election with the National Labor Relations Board. Portlanders could see a new parks levy on their ballot next year. The current levy's funding runs out in 2026, and city officials say the levy needs to be increased to keep up with the cost of maintaining Portland parks and the services they provide. The Parks Bureau gets around 40% of its funding from the levy, which is a property tax. Currently, it's 80 cents per $1,000 of assessed value. For the average homeowner in Portland, that's about $180 a year. The Parks Bureau maintains the city's parks, community centers, and pools, plus it puts on classes, camps, and other programs. Without a new levy, those services could be cut in half in what is already shaping up to be a tough budget cycle for the city. Last week, City Council directed the Parks Bureau to draft a measure for the next ballot, but it would be up to the next City Council whether they'll place it on there for voters to consider. Some polls indicate Portlanders have soured on new taxes, but parks funding could be the exception. An August poll found 65% of survey respondents would support increasing the parks levy to continue funding services. A New Mexico farm has been in the owner's family for more than 400 years. He believes its enduring success is a result of adopting scientific advances while also adhering to sacred family traditions and ancestral farming practices. With more on that story, it's Roz Brown.
A 4.5-acre farm surrounded by New Mexico's Sangre de Cristo Mountains is where owner Don Bustos fuses centuries of tradition with modern advances to feed local communities. The Santa Cruz farm has been in the hands of Bustos' family for more than 400 years. Working with experts at New Mexico State University, he gravitated to organic farming long before others adopted such practices. The 68-year-old Busto says he hasn't used any major chemicals or pesticides in more than 20 years.
We do 72 different varieties of produce 12 months a year using nothing but solar energy. I grow a lot of the traditional corns, the green chili. We still have our same seed. We still have our same corn seed, the same melons. And then we got a lot into the specialty crops.
Bustos believes much of his success is due to taking risks, leaning on scientific advances, while also adhering to sacred family traditions and ancestral farming practices. In addition to solar power, the farm relies on water from a New Mexico acequia an ancient irrigation ditch that flows north through the state. In addition to farming his land, Bustos spent more than a decade working for the American Friends Service Committee, training other New Mexico farmers how to successfully grow organic produce in the middle of winter. Now he's well known for squash, asparagus, leafy greens, and other fresh foods.
We're not trying to save the world. We're just trying to feed our community. So we'll let other people worrying about growing those big mega farms and stuff. As long as we're healthy, our friends are healthy, and our community's healthy, we're good with that.
Using research from NMSU Science Center, the Triple Crown Blackberry, known for its large size and sweet aromatic flavor, is one of his best-selling and most profitable crops. Bustos says a business course through the university also helped him better understand the financial side of farm operations.
I took over the farm in the early 80s, and I just fell in love with it. I would have to make a lot of money, but sometimes that's not the goal. That's not the mission. The mission is to have them doing it.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings and me. The producer is also me, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Brian Bull, Suzanne Potter, Roz Brown, and Eric Tegadoff. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov. Can you believe all of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members? I can! KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st.